Chapter 9. Holotropic States of Consciousness and the Understanding of Art. The work and research into psychedelics and other forms of holotropic states of consciousness have brought revolutionary insights into the understanding of art and artists. Sigmund Freud did pioneering work in this regard, and his followers attempted to apply the observations from their clinical work to the creative process. There are limitations, however, to the approaches that use models of the psyche, which are confined to postnatal biography and Freud's individual unconscious. The explanatory power of depth psychology only increases when the cartography of the psyche is expanded to include the perinatal and transpersonal domains. In our classes at the California Institute of Integral Studies, CIIS, in San Francisco, seminars at Esalen and in Europe, and our joint telecourses, Rick Tarnas and I have tried to demonstrate that combining the extended model of the psyche with archetypal astrology raises the understanding of art to a completely new level. It brings a depth and clarity that was previously unimaginable. Unfortunately, I do not have time in the context of this encyclopedia to explore this fascinating avenue of research. Interested readers will find more information in our writings dedicated to this topic. A more complete treatment of this subject will have to wait for a future publication. Sigmund Freud. The dawn of the 20th century saw the discovery of the unconscious and the birth of depth psychology. This new field was inspired and spearheaded by Sigmund Freud, who practically single-handedly laid its foundations. Initially, Freud's interest in the human psyche was primarily clinical, to explain the etiology of psychoneuroses and to find the way to treat them. However, in the course of his explorations, his horizons expanded enormously to include many cultural phenomena, including art. Freud's work opened up a new, original approach to the understanding of art and artists, and had a profound influence on artistic circles. He attempted to apply the observations from the patient's analyses to understanding the artist's personality, the motives for artistic creation, and the nature of art. According to him, an artist is a person who has withdrawn from reality into his fantasies. The primary sources of these fantasies are Oedipal wishes associated with strong feelings of guilt. The artist finds his way back to the world and society by representing these forbidden wishes in his work. The public, having Oedipal wishes of its own, admires the artist for the courage to express what they have repressed and for relieving them of their guilt. For the artist, the acceptance of his work means that the public shares his guilt, which relieves him of his own guilty feelings. According to Freud, art offers substitutive satisfaction for the oldest and still most deeply felt cultural renunciations of basic biological drives, and for that reason, it serves to reconcile humans with the sacrifice they have made on behalf of civilization. Freud also discovered that it was possible to use psychoanalysis to understand the content of the works of art in the same way that it is possible to understand dreams. Freud's most famous attempt to interpret works of art is his analysis of the ancient Greek tragedy Oedipus Rex by the Athenian playwright Sophocles. In this play, the protagonist Oedipus unwittingly kills his father Laius and marries his mother Jocasta, thus fulfilling the prophecy of the Delphic oracle. Freud's insights into this work were the main source of his famous Oedipus complex. In Freud's own words, Oedipus's destiny moves us only because it might have been ours. Because the oracle laid the same curse upon us before our birth as upon him. It is the fate of all of us, perhaps, to direct our first sexual impulse towards our mother, and our first hatred and our first murderous wish against our father. Our dreams convince us that that is so. Freud also made an interesting attempt to understand Shakespeare's Hamlet. He wanted to be remembered as the psychological detective who found the solution to the problem, the reason for Hamlet's procrastination to kill Claudius. This mystery has been called the Sphinx of modern literature. According to a widely accepted explanation by Goethe, Hamlet represented the type of man whose power of direct action is paralyzed by an excessive development of his intellect. Freud offered a radically different interpretation. Claudius acted out Hamlet's own repressed Oedipal fantasies, and to kill him would be to murder a part of himself. Another one of Freud's famous attempts to understand artists is his analysis of Leonardo da Vinci, based on Leonardo's earliest childhood memory, which he described in mirror writing in one of his notebooks in the Codex Atlanticus. Explaining his obsession with devising a flying machine, Leonardo wrote that when he was a baby, a kite, Nebbio, a small kind of hawk, landed on him and stuck its tail into his mouth, repeatedly hitting his lips with its feathers. Freud concluded that this was a fantasy involving fellation by a phallic mother and also being nursed by her. The idea that the mother has a penis is, according to Freud, a common fantasy of small children. For Freud, this fantasy indicated that Leonardo did not spend his early childhood with his father, as was commonly believed, but with his mother. According to Freud, this had far-reaching consequences for Leonardo's personality, his scientific interests, and his artistic activity. Leonardo's enormous curiosity, which drove him to avid exploration of so many areas, from human and animal anatomy, botany and paleontology, to the laws of mechanics and hydraulics, was the sublimation of a great interest in sexuality that this situation had evoked in him as a child. According to Freud, this insatiable curiosity also interfered with Leonardo's artistic activity and creativity. He painted slowly, and it took him a long time to complete his works. For example, painting the Mona Lisa took him 4 years. This difficulty was responsible for the enormous damage that his famous painting, The Last Supper, which is in the refectory of the convent of Santa Maria delle Grazie in Milan, has suffered over the course of the centuries. Leonardo chose the slow process of painting with oil colors, rather than the more durable al fresco technique that required much faster activity. According to Freud, the excessive sublimation of the sexual drive also inhibited Leonardo's sexual life. Leonardo was very shy and sexually withdrawn and blocked. He was repulsed by the sexual act, and with a few exceptions, several drawings of the anatomy of pregnancy and a strange drawing of sexual intercourse, avoided sexual topics. He did not seem to have a relationship with a woman, and liked beautiful young men as his models and students. During his apprenticeship with Verrocchio, he was accused of homosexual relationships. Freud attributed Leonardo's homosexual tendencies to the disappointment that he experienced as a child when he discovered that his mother did not have a penis. Freud also pointed out Leonardo's conflicts in relation to aggression. He was a vegetarian and was known for buying captured birds in the market and letting them go. However, as an engineer for Ludovico Forza, he designed a large number of war machines, some of them truly diabolical. All through his study, Freud put great emphasis on the fact that the bird in Leonardo's childhood experience was a vulture. He pointed out that ancient Egyptians believed that there were only female vultures and that they were inseminated by the wind while flying. This belief was used by Christian church fathers as an argument for the possibility of immaculate conception. Freud found surprising support for his thesis in the work of Oscar Pfister, a Lutheran minister and lay analyst, who suggested that Leonardo's painting, The Virgin and Child with Saint Anne, contained a hidden figure of a vulture, with its tail near the mouth of the child. This discovery is extremely puzzling, because Freud's references to a vulture were based on a linguistic error. The term nebbio, used in Leonardo's description of his childhood memory, actually means a kite, milvus milvus, and not a vulture, gyps fulvus. When Freud discovered this error, he was deeply disappointed because, as he confessed to Lou Andrea Salome in a letter of February 9, 1919, he regarded the Leonardo essay to be the only beautiful thing I have ever written. According to Freud, the complexity of Leonardo's relationship with his mother found its expression in the mysterious, ambiguous, Leonardesque smile on Leonardo's Mona Lisa. Simultaneously cold and sensual, seductive and reserved, to paint her took Leonardo an extremely long time. The painting was considered unfinished when he took it with him to France after 4 years of working on it. This smile also figures prominently in some of his other paintings, including St. John the Baptist and Bacchus, as well as others. It is important to mention Freud's concession that psychoanalysis only has relevance for understanding the content of works of art, but has nothing to contribute to the phenomenon of genius. Freud's attempt to analyze artists and works of art was a pioneering venture into a new field, but essentially a major failure. Erich Neumann's Jungian essay, entitled Art and the Creative Unconscious, Leonardo da Vinci and the Mother Archetype, offered a strong criticism of Freud's interpretations, pointing out some major factual errors that made Freud's argument and his essay irrelevant. It also shows how the understanding of art changes when we introduce the transpersonal perspective of the Jungian collective unconscious and the archetypal dynamics. Neumann presented evidence that Leonardo lived with his father and stepmother in his grandfather's house and was brought up by his grandmother, not his mother. These facts disqualified Freud's speculations about Leonardo's relationship with his mother and its effect on his curiosity, sexual orientation, and art, which was the cornerstone of his essay. Neumann also demonstrated that Freud's far-reaching speculations considering the vulture in Leonardo's childhood memory involved Freud's serious linguistic error. However, for Neumann, Freud's linguistic error was of relatively little significance. He not only corrected the factual errors in Freud's study, but he also shifted the focus of Leonardo's analysis to the archetypal level, bringing in the element of higher creativity. For Jungians, the inspiration of a genius comes from the archetypal domain, not from the biographical domain. See also James Hillman's The Soul's Code. For Neumann, Leonardo's bird was the ouroboric symbol of the Great Mother, who is both male and female. It is the archetypal feminine, the all-generative power of nature and creative source of the unconscious. The nursing mother is ouroboric. Her breasts are often represented as being phallic. She is nourishing and fecundating the male as well as the female child. It was Leonardo's connection with the archetypal Great Mother that, according to Neumann, was the source of his immense creativity. Leonardo's driving force was of a spiritual, not sexual nature. Thus, the Great Mother is ouroboric, terrible and devouring, beneficent and creative, a helper, but also alluring and destructive, a maddening enchantress, yet a bringer of wisdom, bestial and divine, voluptuous harlot, an inviolable virgin, immemorially old and eternally young. Mona Lisa, with her enormous richness, ambiguity, and mysteriousness, did not reflect Leonardo's strongly ambivalent relationship with his biological mother. Instead, she clearly represents an anima figure, Sophia. As far as the image of the vulture hidden in Leonardo's painting is concerned, it might have been a joke. Leonardo, known for his playfulness and for his strong opposition to all secular and religious authority, might have used it to ridicule the attempt of the church fathers to use the allegedly unisex vulture to support the possibility of immaculate conception. Freud's attempt to apply psychoanalysis to the understanding of Fyodor Mikhailovich Dostoevsky in his article Dostoevsky and Parricide was equally unsuccessful. In this essay, Freud concluded that Dostoevsky did not suffer from epilepsy, an organic neurological disease, but hysteria, a psychoneurosis caused by emotional trauma. He attributed great significance to the rumor that Dostoevsky's father was murdered by his serfs and asserted that this was the cause of Dostoevsky's alleged epilepsy. According to Freud, the ecstasy that Dostoevsky experienced at the beginning of his seizures, aura, reflected his joy at the news of his hated father's death and his own ensuing liberation. The ecstasy was followed by a fall, a loud scream, convulsions, and unconsciousness, typical manifestations of grand mal epilepsy. The slow and confused recovery was associated with depression and a profound feeling of guilt, as if he had committed a great crime. Freud interpreted these symptoms as a punishment imposed on him by his superego, his father's authority introjected into his unconscious. Dostoevsky's whole life, Freud wrote, is dominated by his twofold attitude to the father-czar authority, by voluptuous masochistic submission on the one hand, and by outraged rebellion against it on the other. Freud's conclusions were seriously criticized by neurologists as well as historians. Dostoevsky's disease was epilepsy, not hysteria, and his father was not murdered. Freud's interpretation of Goethe's Poetry and Truth and Wilhelm Jensen's Gradiva, as well as Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice and King Lear, did not bring any major revelations. In Poetry and Truth, Freud introduced the concept of sibling rivalry and used it to explain little Goethe's destruction of a dollhouse by attributing it to his anger about the birth of his sister. However, he was not able to bring any evidence that these two events actually coincided in time. In Gradiva, Freud used the image of Pompeii covered by volcanic ashes as a dramatic illustration of a childhood memory buried in the unconscious. His analysis of the two Shakespeare plays is also complex, convoluted, and unconvincing. Marie Bonaparte. The most interesting attempt to apply psychoanalysis to art is the trilogy on the life and works of Edgar Allan Poe, written by Greek princess Marie Bonaparte, an enthusiastic follower of Freud who arranged his safe escape from Nazi Germany. Like her teacher and idol, she used the Oedipus complex as the basic explanatory principle and source of artistic inspiration. This is reflected in the basic structure of her three-volume opus. The first volume is an extremely detailed reconstruction of Poe's biography. The second one, Tales of the Mother, focuses on the stories that, according to Bonaparte, were inspired by Poe's relationship with his mother, Elizabeth Arnold. She was a frail actress, dying of tuberculosis, to which she succumbed before little Edgar was 3 years old. These stories describe seriously ill and dying female lovers and wives who suffer from mysterious afflictions, including Berenice, Morella, Lygia, Rowena, Eleonora, Lady Madeline, and others. Some other stories in this volume feature the murder of a female figure, portray the mother as a landscape, or represent a confession of impotence. The third volume, Tales of the Father, presents an analysis of the stories that reflected his relationship with male authority. These involved either a revolt against the father figure, patricide, masochistic surrender to the father, or a struggle with conscience, superego. The male figures in Poe's life were as equally problematic as the female ones. His father, David, was an erratic and intractable alcoholic who also suffered from tuberculosis. He disappeared in New York City when Poe was 18 months old. After his mother's death, little Edgar was taken into the home of Frances Allen and adopted by the couple more or less against the will of her husband, John Allen, a Scotch merchant who was a strict disciplinarian and became Poe's second father figure. Marie Bonaparte's basic tenet is that works of art reveal the creator's psychology, particularly the dynamics of the unconscious. She described Poe's unconscious as extremely active and full of horrors and torments, and mentioned explicitly that without his literary genius, he would have spent his life in prison or in a mental institution. She attributed the blood appearing in several of Poe's stories to his observation of hemoptysis, coughing of blood, a frequent symptom of tuberculosis. She also attributed great significance to the fact that in the restricted quarters in which his poor parents lived, little Edgar very likely experienced the famous Freudian primal scene, observed their sexual activities, and interpreted them as sadistic acts. Bonaparte's conceptual framework is limited to postnatal biography and to the Freudian individual unconscious. Although Poe's early life was difficult, it is not a convincing source of the kind of horrors found in his stories. Bonaparte makes several references to birth and the maternal womb, but, as is common with most psychoanalysts, her language shifts at this point from memories to fantasies. Like Freud, she refuses to accept the possibility that prenatal life and birth could be recorded in the unconscious as actual memories. However, many of Poe's stories, particularly the most macabre and emotionally powerful ones, have unmistakable perinatal features. For example, Poe's story A Descent into the Maelstrom, a hair-raising adventure of three Norwegian brothers, shows a deep resemblance to the experience of the engulfing whirlpool, which typically accompanies the reliving of the onset of birth, BPM-2. The boat the brothers are using during their fishing expedition is entrapped by the monstrous maelstrom and drawn relentlessly toward its center. Two of the brothers lose their lives in a hopeless fight with this raging force of nature. The third one, using an ingenious strategy, makes a fortuitous escape after a close encounter with death and survives to tell the story. The prison of the Inquisition described in Poe's story, The Pit and the Pendulum, with its diabolical torments and its contracting and eventually fiery walls, from which the hero is rescued at the last moment, has many characteristics of the delivering uterus. Similarly, the escape of the dwarf, Hopfrog, from the torturous ambiance of the royal court, described in Poe's novel of the same name, resembles rebirth experiences, BPM 3 and 4, from holotropic breathwork and psychedelic sessions. In this book, when the clever court jester is asked to devise a special form of entertainment for a masked ball, he camouflages the cruel king and his ministers as orangutans by using tar and flax, and then sets them ablaze. In the ensuing mayhem, he climbs up a rope to a hole in the ceiling to unite with his female companion, Tripita. The experience of being buried alive, Poe's favorite theme that appears in many of his stories, including premature burial, the cask of Amontillado, loss of breath, the fall of the House of Usher, and others, is a frequent motif in perinatal sessions. Many perinatal motifs are also found in Poe's longest, strange, and mystifying novel entitled The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. Marie Bonaparte's interpretive approach, which was limited to the Freudian model, proves most inadequate when she uses it in the analysis of Poe's Eureka. This magnificent vision of cosmic creation is very different from anything that Poe had ever written. The reaction to its publication ranged from critical to highly positive, including praise from scientists. Albert Einstein made the following comment in a letter written in 1934. Eureka is eine sehr schöne Leistung eines ungewöhnlich selbstständigen Geistes, a very beautiful achievement of an unusually independent mind. In his introduction, Poe promises to speak about the material and spiritual universe, about its essence, its origin, creation, its present condition, and its destiny. When writing about these things, he capitalizes the first letters of nouns and adjectives in a way that psychiatric patients often do. Marie Bonaparte sees this as a sign of psychopathology, but it is clearly an indication that Poe was tapping deep transpersonal sources. For this reason, his experience, like the experiences of the mystics, could not be adequately conveyed in ordinary language. Poe's cosmological vision has a deep resemblance to the worldviews of the great spiritual philosophies of the East, particularly their tantric branches. He describes the creation of the universe as a process that begins in a singularity and involves a series of countless divisions and differentiations. This then creates a counter-reaction, the tendency to return to the original unity. The continued existence of the universe also requires a third force, which is repulsion, preventing the coalition of the separated parts. The parallels between Poe's singularity and Mahabindu, the source of the creation of the universe described in tantric scriptures, is remarkable. The same is true for Poe's three cosmic forces, which have the characteristics of the tantric gunas, tamas, sattva, and rajas, which are feminine powers of creation. The final aim which the completed universe strives toward, then, is the ultimate reunion with God. The sole function of the repulsive force would be to delay that reunion. In my book, The Cosmic Game, Explorations of the Frontiers of Human Consciousness, I have described a similar cosmology that emerged from the psychedelic and holotropic breathwork sessions of the people participating in my research. Like my clients' insights, Poe's cosmological vision has a strong resemblance not only to the scriptures of the spiritual systems that Aldous Huxley called perennial philosophy, but also to theories of modern science, in this case to cosmological speculations of famous physicists based on astronomical observations. Poe himself believed that his Eureka would revolutionize astronomy, and his ideas have actually been seriously discussed in scientific circles. One of Poe's major hypotheses, that the universe filled with matter after a single high-energy particle exploded, is the rough equivalent of the cosmogenetic theory developed in the 20th century by Lemaître, Gamow, and Alpha. Its opponent, Fred Hoyle, referred to it facetiously as the Big Bang Theory, and it has been known by this name ever since. It has remained one of the leading cosmogenetic theories to this day. Poe theorized that the universe must be expanding, since the energy of the explosion is pushing matter outward. He also concluded that eventually gravity would pull all particles back together, and the process would start all over again. This idea appeared in Alexander Friedman's theory of the pulsating universe. In Eureka, Poe also offered a reasonable solution to Olbers' paradox of the dark sky that plagued astronomers. A static universe with an infinite number of stars could not be dark unless some of the stars are so far that the light would not reach us. Modern consciousness research has shown that visionary states have a remarkable potential to provide not only extraordinary religious illumination and artistic inspiration, but also brilliant scientific insights that open new fields and facilitate scientific problem solving. Numerous examples of this kind can be found in the excellent book by Willis Harmon, entitled Higher Creativity: Liberating the Unconscious for Breakthrough Insights. We will return to this important subject in the next chapter. Considering Poe's brilliant insights that matched those of professional scientists, Bonaparte was most blatantly reductionistic in her analysis of Eureka. For her, Poe's God was his physical father, and the creation of the cosmos referred to the biological creative act. Poe's original particle, from which the cosmos evolved, was allegedly the spermatozoan. In his fantasy, the universe was purportedly created by a father figure without female participation. Yearning for the original unity was a return to the father and reflected Poe's detachment from the feminine. Poe's cosmic fantasy about multiple universes reflected the fact that there were other siblings in his family. According to Bonaparte, Eureka revealed Poe's avoidance of mother and woman. He thus ended his literary career with a cosmic homosexual fantasy. I hope that this brief excursion into Marie Bonaparte's Freudian interpretation of art showed that the expanded cartography of the psyche, including the perinatal and transpersonal domains, provides a much deeper, richer and convincing conceptual framework for a psychological analysis of the content of works of art. Otto Rank. Otto Rank disagreed with Freud's insistence on the primacy of the Oedipus complex as the source of artistic inspiration. According to him, the artist's creativity is driven by a profound need to come to terms with the primordial anxiety associated with the trauma of birth, Urangst, and to the return to the safety of the maternal womb. Rank's general thesis concerned the paramount importance of the memory of birth as a powerful motivating force in the psyche, which was convincingly supported by modern work with holotropic states of consciousness. Instead of emphasizing the desire to return to the womb, though, it shifted the focus to the drive to relive the trauma of the passage through the birth canal, and to experience psycho-spiritual death and rebirth. As we saw earlier, it was actually possible to identify specific experiential patterns related to the four consecutive stages of birth, basic perinatal matrices, BPMs, and describe the specific psychodynamic significance of each of them. This research has also shown that the mythological figures and realms of the psyche are not derived from the trauma of birth, as Rank believed, but are expressions of archetypes, autonomous organizing principles of the collective unconscious. Instead of being products of birth memories, they are instrumental in forming and informing the experiences in the different stages of birth. Thus, Rank saw the Sphinx and other demonic female figures, such as Hecate, Gorgo, the Sirens, and the Harpies, as representations of the anxiety-laden mother of childbirth, rather than figures belonging to a superordinated archetypal domain. Carl Gustav Jung. As we will see in the following section, this is the perspective that emerged from the therapeutic work of another renegade from the psychoanalytic movement, C.G. Jung. Jung strongly disagreed with Freud's idea that the motivation for artistic creation is to share forbidden Oedipal fantasies. According to him, the secret of artistic creation and the effectiveness of art is to be found in the return to the state of participation mystique, to that level of experience at which it is the collective man who lives and not the individual. It was not Goethe who created Faust, it was the archetype of Faust that created Goethe. Another major point of dissent between Jung and Freud was the concept of libido. For Jung, libido was not a biological drive, but a universal force comparable to Aristotle's entelechy or Henri Bergson's élan vital. This understanding of art answers the problem of genius that Freud was not able to account for by using the explanatory principles of his psychoanalysis. The phenomenon of genius cannot be understood in terms of individual psychology. According to Jung, the genius functions as a channel for cosmic creative energy of the world's soul, anima mundi. Jung also rejected Freud's model of the psyche because it was limited to postnatal biography and the individual unconscious. He extended it to include the collective unconscious with its historical and mythological domains. The concept of the collective unconscious and its organizing principles, the archetypes, brought the depth that Freudian psychology could not provide to artistic analysis. Jung's first major attempt to analyze art was his extensive analysis of the partly poetic, partly prosaic book of an American woman, Miss Frank Miller, which was published in Geneva by Theodore Flournoy and became known as the Miller Fantasies. Jung's analysis of this book, entitled Symbols of Transformation, was a work of major historical importance because its publication marked the beginning of a break between Jung and Freud. The method of amplification that Jung used in the analysis of Miss Miller's book became the model for the Jungian approach to the analysis of dreams, psychotic experiences, art, and other manifestations of the psyche. This technique consists of finding parallels between the motifs and figures of analyzed work in folklore, history, literature, art, and mythology of other cultures, and revealing their archetypal sources. Jung had a profound influence on modern writers and filmmakers. Like Freud's famous concepts, the Oedipus complex, castration complex, vagina dentata, the id, and the superego, Jung's descriptions of the principal archetypes, the shadow, anima, animus, trickster, terrible mother, wise old man, and others, not only provided insights into already existing works of art, but also inspiration for generations of new artists. Contribution of psychedelic research to the understanding of art. The serendipitous discovery of the powerful psychedelic effect of LSD by Albert Hofmann and the experimentation with this extraordinary substance brought revolutionary discoveries concerning consciousness, the human psyche, and the creative process. For historians and critics of art, the LSD experiments provided extraordinary new insights into the psychology and psychopathology of art. They saw a deep similarity between the paintings of normal subjects depicting their LSD visions and the outsider art, art brut, and the art of psychiatric patients, as was documented in Hans Prinzhorn's classic Artistry of the Mentally Ill, Walter Morgenthaler's book Madness and Art, and Roger Cardinal's Outsider Art. Other psychedelic paintings bore a deep resemblance to artifacts of native cultures, such as African masks and fetishes, the sculptures of the New Guinea tribes of the Sepik River, bark paintings of the Australian Aborigines, yarn paintings of the Mexican Huichol Indians, Chumash cave paintings in Southern California, and others. There was also an unmistakable similarity between the art of LSD subjects and that of representatives of various modern movements. Abstractionism, Expressionism, Impressionism, Cubism, Dadaism, Surrealism, and Fantastic Realism. For professional painters who participated in LSD research, psychedelic sessions often marked a radical change in their artistic expression. Their imagination became much richer, their colors more vivid, and their style considerably freer. On occasion, people who had never painted before were able to produce extraordinary drawings and paintings. It seemed that the power of the deep unconscious material that had surfaced in their sessions somehow took over the process and used the subject as a channel for artistic expression. However, the impact of LSD and other psychedelic substances on art went much further than influencing the style of the artists who volunteered as experimental subjects. An entire generation of avant-garde young artists embraced them as tools for finding deep inspiration in the perinatal domain and in the archetypal realm of the collective unconscious. They portrayed, with extraordinary artistic power, a rich array of experiences that originated in these deep and ordinarily hidden recesses of the human psyche. Their self-experimentation also led to serious interest in areas closely related to their psychedelic experiences. Study of the great Eastern spiritual philosophies, intense meditation practice, participation in shamanic rituals, worship of the goddess and of the sacred feminine, nature mysticism, and various esoteric teachings. Many of them documented their own spiritual and philosophical quests in their art. Psychedelic therapy and self-experimentation with psychedelics by psychiatrists and psychologists also contributed to interpretations of art and to art criticism. It revealed the inadequacy of the mainstream model of the psyche and the need for its radical extension and revision. In an earlier chapter, I described my own proposal for such a new model based on the experiences and observations from the research of holotropic states. I would like to close this chapter with a brief review of one of the first attempts to use my extended cartography of the psyche in the analysis of art. It is a brilliant study of the great French writer and philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, entitled Sartre's Rite of Passage. It was written 35 years ago by Tom Riedlinger and published in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. It brought convincing evidence that significant aspects of Jean-Paul Sartre's writing and his existential philosophy can be understood through his poorly managed and unresolved psychedelic session that focused on the perinatal level. In February 1935, Sartre was given an intramuscular injection of mescaline at St. Anne's Hospital in Le Havre, France. He was 29 years old, unpublished and unknown, and worked as a college philosophy teacher. He was writing a book on imagination and hoped that the drug would induce visions and give him some insights into the dynamics of the psyche. His wish was fulfilled, but he got more than he bargained for. When his partner Simone de Beauvoir called him in the afternoon of his session, he told her that her call had rescued him from a desperate battle with octopuses. As we saw earlier, the octopus is a frequent symbol of BPM-2, representing the termination of freedom experienced in the aquatic setting of the womb. Sartre also experienced massive optical illusions. The objects in the environment were grotesquely changing their shape, becoming symbols of death. Umbrellas were transforming into vultures and shoes into skeletons, and human faces looked monstrous. He was afraid that he was losing his mind. All of these are typical manifestations of BPM-2. He saw frightful apparitions for the rest of the evening. The next morning, he seemed to be completely recovered. But several days later, he began suffering recurrent attacks of depression and anxiety and felt pursued by various aquatic monsters, such as giant lobsters and crabs. Houses had leering faces, eyes, and jaws, and every clock face seemed to turn into an owl. These states continued until summer. Sartre made his own diagnosis. I am suffering from a chronic hallucinatory psychosis. He blamed the psychiatrist Lagache, who gave him the mescaline, for his bad trip. He was rather saturnine and told him during the preparation for the session, "What it does to you is terrible." Sartre himself insisted that the drug was not primarily responsible for what was happening to him. He called its effect incidental and thought that the primary profound cause of his reaction was his pervasive identity crisis resulting from his passage to adulthood. He was unwilling to accept the social responsibilities imposed on the individual by bourgeois society. However, Sartre's visions clearly had much deeper and earlier roots than his identity crisis and his fear of being swallowed by bourgeois society. Similar confrontation with deep-dwelling oceanic monsters is recorded in Les Mots, Sartre's autobiography of his childhood. There he described that when he was 8 years old, he discovered the power of creative writing. Whenever he started experiencing anguish, he took his heroes on wild adventures. Sartre's typical childhood heroes were geologists and deep-sea divers fighting various subterranean or undersea monsters. A giant octopus, a gigantic tarantula, or a 20-ton crustacean, all of which are creatures that play an important role in psychedelic and holotropic breathwork sessions focusing on the perinatal level, BPM 2. About this, Sartre said, "What flowed from my pen was I myself, a child monster. It was my boredom with life, my fear of death, my dullness and my perversity." It seems that the mescaline session activated a COX system associated with the second perinatal matrix, and its effect continued long after the pharmacological action of mescaline had subsided. The layers of this COX reached far back into Sartre's childhood. Its most important common denominator was a sense of the pervasive presence of death. His father died at the age of 30, less than 2 years after Sartre was born. His mother, concerned about her husband's disease, stopped lactating. Sartre had a strong reaction to weaning and developed severe enteritis. His life from then on had a funereal taste. At the age of 5, he saw death as a tall madwoman dressed in black. When he looked at her, she muttered, "I will put that child in my pocket." As a child, Sartre responded strongly to the disease of his friend and to the death of his grandmother. When he was 7, he lived in a state of terror that the shadowy mouth of death could open anywhere and snap me up. When he looked in a mirror, he saw himself as a jellyfish hitting against the glass of the aquarium. Other children shunned him as a playmate, and he felt abandoned and alone. In his daydreams, he would discover what he called a monstrous universe that was the underside of my impotence. He said about it, "I did not invent these horrors. I found them in my memory." Many aspects of Sartre's problems and his work can be understood as a strong influence of BPM 2. Fear of death and insanity, the horror of engulfment, preoccupation with aquatic monsters, a sense of the absurdity of life and other elements of existentialist philosophy, loneliness, inferiority, and guilt. His famous play even carries the title No Exit, Huit Clos. In the critical years of his life, Sartre saw himself strained to the breaking point between two extremes, being born and dying with each heartbeat. This strange experiential amalgam of dying and being born is again a characteristic feature of perinatal dynamics. The tension reached unbearable proportions a few months before Sartre's 30th birthday. Using the strategy of denying death that Ernest Becker called the Immortality Project, he attempted to rob death of its sting by writing and fantasizing that he would reach post-mortem fame. However, his efforts at the time failed, and he did not succeed in getting published. He was also realizing that he was approaching the age at which his father died. His COX system with death, as the central theme, was thus close to the surface when Sartre took mescaline. It intensified and partially emerged into consciousness, but it was not resolved. Its elements appear throughout Le Nusée, a book he started writing at the time of the mescaline session. It seemed that working on it helped Sartre integrate the experience. It deals with issues such as nausea, suffocation, and scatological elements, sticky, rotten filth. There are also references to sea monsters and the uncanny chestnut tree, the tree of death from Sartre's childhood described in Les Mots. A more comprehensive discussion of the advantages of the expanded cartography for the analysis of artworks can be found in my book, Modern Consciousness Research and the Understanding of Art. An important part of this book is a selection of the paintings, drawings, and sculptures of the Swiss genius of fantastic realism, Hans-Rudi Giger. There cannot be more obvious proof for the importance of the perinatal domain of the unconscious in understanding art than his creations.